China's working on its Made in China 2025 push.
The U.S. is playing with fire, but China has fire too.
Global economic powerhouse.
Young Chinese people are becoming disillusioned with everyday life.
China's mobile payment.
Cashless.
A cashless society.
All use QR codes.
China. People think I don't like China. I love China.
Hi guys, welcome to another episode of China, What's the Future? Today we will talk about Chinese luxury consumers. We will be covering three topics. The Chinese luxury consumer themselves, we always start with people and culture, and then looking at the industry, and finally where the industry is going in the future. So we have a very special guest with us today. Hi Sarah.
Hi Arnold.
Sarah, you're probably one of our most famous guests we've had on here, certainly the most successful. So Sarah, you grew up in Hong Kong. And you studied in America, I believe?
Yeah, so I grew up in Hong Kong, but when I was 14 years old, I left Hong Kong to go to the States. I was in the States for a very long time for education. I went to Phillips Exeter Academy boarding school, where actually I was two years below Mark Zuckerberg.
Really?
So he was my year. And I regret not knowing him better.
I'm guessing he was a quite quiet guy.
Well, you know, it's American high school. So people who are popular, like the jocks, they play ice hockey. They're not in their dorm rooms coding all day. And then I went to Georgetown University for my undergrad, where I was an English major. I loved reading. I loved writing. And then I did my MBA at Harvard Business School. But because I was really inspired to start my first business, which is a finishing school, high-end etiquette school, I moved back to Beijing after HBS in order to start this. But my family's always been in Hong Kong, so I kind of, and you know, Cantonese is my mother tongue because Cantonese is what's spoken in Hong Kong. So when I moved in 2012 to Beijing, my Mandarin was really conversational at best, like, and not even, it was very broken and very rocky. But I would say that today, you know, 7 years later, my biggest personal achievement is not any career achievement, but rather the fact that when I speak Mandarin, people think they don't believe I'm from Hong Kong.
Do you have a Beijing accent?
Beijing Koyin.
Really? Chuar.
Yang Rou Chuar.
And then in 2013, you were listed as a future woman in the mix in Asia, 12 to watch in 2015, and also 30 under 30 for BBC 100 Women. That's a lot of things in 2 years. How did you get yourself into that position where you were kind of like so well recognized for your achievements?
I just think I was very lucky. I think it's
very humble. No,
I think it's I was the right person at the right place at the right time. Because, you know, China's an emerging power, especially around 2012, everybody was talking about China. Incomes have risen quickly, but taste has not risen as quickly as incomes have risen. But people are hungry to upgrade their lives and become citizens of the world and better versions of themselves. This is something really unique to Chinese women. They're always saying, oh, I need to be better at this. Oh, I need to go learn that. All my Chinese friends are studying something. You know, no matter what age, they're studying, learning calligraphy, learning music, learning how to sing, learning how to dance, learning etiquette. And so that was what inspired me to start my etiquette school, because I felt that, okay, you know, I think that each generation is getting better as it become better traveled, better educated. And so I think that, you know, when you have something that you are really passionate about, that's true to you and that you love doing, and that, you know, a certain set of people need and that can also make money, and you just put your head down and do it, then everything just kind of comes along.
And because of that, your kind of like etiquette school and the finishing, and is that why you publish your book on the back of your experience running an etiquette school? Do you want to talk about the book a little bit for our audience?
Yeah, well, you know, I myself went to Swiss finishing school, which is where I was inspired to bring the concept to China. Everywhere else in the world, finishing school is seen as something elegant. In China, it's seen as something for air hostesses or for waitresses. It's not seen as something elegant. So I had to redefine the meaning of etiquette and what I was doing. So I did that by, you know, our first office was in the Park Hyatt Residences in Yintai Zhongxing, which is the most expensive address, you know, 7 years ago in Beijing. And then I hired the sous chef from the French embassy. So every day he was making souffle, foie gras, et cetera, for our students. You know, all of our porcelain was like collector item. you know, we have courses like Western table manners, dress codes, table conversation. But I also innovated some courses based on my clients' needs. So I noticed they were all buying luxury brands, but they didn't really know how to pronounce them. So I was like, all right, pronunciation of foreign luxury brands. It's Hermes, not Hermes. It's Givenchy, not Givenchy. It's Versace, not Versace. So, so they, you know, they found that like immediately useful and practical.
Yeah,
and then I'm a show jumper. I like to do equestrian. I like to ride. And I would take them to see, you know, they'd come to watch me ride. I would take them to the China Open to watch tennis. And one of them took me aside. She said, you know, Sarah, I've been living in London, studying in London for 6 years, but I don't quite understand how a game of tennis is played, is scored. It's like, that's so interesting. Because, wow. You know, in the rest of the world, or in the West, at least, we grow up playing tennis. So, you know, so then I was like, huh, well, a new course, Introduction to Expensive Sports. And of course, you know, our etiquette school, we service like, you know, kind of the top of the pyramid, the elite women, very affluent women in China who are either businesswomen or the wives of very successful businessmen. But I wanted to reach a wider audience. And hence, I came out with a book. So what's interesting actually is that what we were doing when I say sort of right person, right place, right time, what we were doing with the etiquette school was also in line with what the Chinese government is interested in, which is upgrading citizens to be citizens of the world. And they had a really big focus on manners, on etiquette. They even published, you know, like a really big handbook on what on the etiquette of different countries. So the government did this. And so CITIC, CITIC is a huge conglomerate in China. They're also the biggest publishing house. They approached me. They said, you know, we've been watching what you've been doing and we want to create more etiquette books because it's all kind of top down, right, in China. And so they, which is great, because if I didn't have time to go pitch and it wasn't on my mind to write a book yet. But they approached me and they said, we would love for you to write an etiquette book. So we published it in 2016. And it's really fun and cheeky because to me, again, part of redefining etiquette is that everybody thinks it's a middle-aged woman wearing like a suit with, you know, a bun on her head. But actually, I feel that, and, you know, they all think it's so, it's outdated, it's too strict, it's too formal. But I actually think that etiquette, it changes with time and it's flexible. It's not so much about, you know, what fork to use or what to do. Like it's about making other people around you feel comfortable around you. I think that's the true spirit of etiquette. We have gym etiquette, right? So because in China, even to this day, I'm a member of Kerry Gym in Beijing, which is considered the nicest gym. Yeah. But every now and then you'll see somebody wearing jeans on the treadmill. Or you'll see like, you know, women with like hair down to their waist, not tied up. They're like, you know, walking on the treadmill.
That's just common sense, right? It's uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah, it's common sense. And you know, in the West or, you know, in the rest of the world, it's like when we go to the gym, you take off your makeup. Well, in China, it's like they put on their makeup to go to the gym. So, yeah. But, you know, so a lot of these, I think that because there was never a gym culture before, right? So it's not like the parents' generation were telling the kids this. No one told you. And so, you know, they're going in flip-flops, walking on the treadmill in flip-flops. I mean, there's like, you know, taking the weights and then just like leaving them wherever. You know, it's like wherever they lost, use them.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the etiquette is that you should put it back. So I wanted my book to be really practical, but also really fun. I think that you have to, when I think back on the professors I had, whether in college or at university, my favorite courses were the ones where it was engaging and it was entertaining and it was fun. And I think that's the best way for people to learn. So the book it's fun, it's an easy read, and at the same time, it's educational.
It's great. You know what, I agree with a lot of things you're saying, and I think because China has, and we talk about this a lot, because China has changed so much over the last 40 years, and we always talk about how it grew at 10% year on year. And at the start of that growth, China was very much literally just full of farmers. So I think a lot of what you're saying is related to a bigger thing, which is essentially social disposition, right? It's about whether people's disposition can change fast enough to catch up to the socioeconomic growth. So you're saying about kind of like people, citizens of the world, and I think Chinese people are so used to being kind of like a country on its own, and the culture has been set for so many years. It's very difficult, and suddenly opening them to the world is very difficult for people to get used to that. And I think it's very great what you're doing is kind of actually effecting that change and helping people to become global citizens. And It's really noble.
Yeah, I often say that no other country has gone through so much change in such a short amount of time.
Yeah, we say this literally the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you look at, you know, America, the Industrial Revolution took 150 years, and then, you know, continental expansion happened like maybe a little, it was a bit more condensed, but it was in parallel with US expansion. Whereas exactly. China, like you said, in 40 years, you know, you have industrial services, technological revolution all in one.
And it's still changing. In fact, it's changed beyond what the rest of the world has managed to achieve in a much longer period. And it's an exciting time to be alive. So China has 500 billionaires, just slightly behind the US. I think at the moment about 535. But what's more astonishing, and I guess it's more relevant to brands, is that China has 3.5 million millionaires. And that's up from 180,000 in 2016, which is 20 times the amount just 12 years ago. This is a very important industry for a lot of brands. But I guess at Qmin, we try to talk about the people and the culture first before we go into the industry and the marketing and strategy. So first, I want to ask you a few questions, Sarah, about the Chinese luxury consumer. Obviously, because this is your world. You're your etiquette school. You're teaching them about cultural disposition, the book you've written, the people you interview. So I guess the first thing that's on everyone's mind normally is that what really drives a purchasing decision from the high net worth individuals in China? What do they look for in a brand? Do you find it is, you talked about Hermes, do you find it is because of the brand heritage that they prefer these products, or is it something else? Is it quality?
You know, I think it's just like everyone all over the world. I mean, when you look at 100 years ago when America was just rising as a global superpower, and Americans were going to Italy and they were buying antiques in cash, right? And that shocked everybody. Or the Russians, right? When the Russians were coming up. And now the Chinese. So I think it's a natural progression of any nation where, you know, the citizens are getting a lot richer. I think the difference with Chinese luxury buyers is that they're younger. So, for example, Porsche, you know, I mean, or even Bentley, or, you know, et cetera, maybe Rolls Royces. So brands that are in the West, maybe a more mature buyer. Mm. In China, they're all born in the 80s. So, you know, they're in their 30s. And you're getting many in their 20s. So there are 400 million millennials in China out of a 1.4 billion population. There are, you know, so separate from millennials, if you look at how many people are upper middle class, and by upper middle class, we define that as owning a home, owning a car, annual incomes of, you know, 20,000 US or above, you have 246 million people in China that are upper middle class. And by 2025, 40% of the world's luxury market will be in China. It'll be taken over by Chinese consumers. So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, numbers that are bigger than the entire US population right now. The Xi economy, right, the Xi economy, which is a big thing all over the world. But in China, the Xi economy, female shoppers, over the past 5 years, there's been an 81% increase on the average spend that female buyers buy on Taobao. So they're spending more and more on themselves. Yeah. Women want to invest in themselves.
And that's a big cultural shift, right? Because previously, it's always been about the family, about the people around you, especially as a kind of like a matriarch in the family.
And they still do that. They make most of the purchasing decisions for the family, but they're also focusing on things for themselves. So skincare, feminine care, beauty machines, you know, all sorts of these kinds of things. And so the Xi economy market in China is about 700 billion US last year in 2018.
Wow.
Which, if you rank that as, you know, if it, by GDP as a country, it'd be the 18th largest economy in the world. So that's just female spending. Now, the other thing is all happening online. So 30% of all retail in China happens online versus in America, 10%.
Mm.
So that just gives you an idea.
Do you think that Xi economy, is it Xi economy? Am I saying that right?
Yeah, the Xi
economy. Do you think that's related to luxury purchasing, in the sense that people are starting to, especially women, are starting to buy things for themselves, start to treat themselves, whether it's like handbags or kind of like clothes? Is that a driver in the way that they purchase luxury brands?
I think that's what luxury brands have done so well. Is, I mean, they're aspirational brands. So, you know, when when people make money, the first thing they want to do is conspicuous consumption, right? So it's the hat, it's the Louis Vuitton handbag, it's the Chanel suit, or it's the Porsche car. Mm. And then slowly, so actually I've been to the homes of some very rich Chinese people, and compared to, let's say, in the West, you know, people will really like to entertain in the home, you know, in a middle American housewives, you know, they love to spend time and design their home in a comfortable way. In China, you can go to a very rich person's house and they won't have put any effort in the home because it's just not conspicuous. And so that's why, you know, home living, even though you have Zara home entering, etc., it's definitely a growing market, but it's still behind, you know, what you can put and what you can show people as soon as you walk out on the street. Now, first you have, you know, all the brands, and now women people in general are starting to focus on sort of the internal them. So whether that's, you know, studying, you know, learning how to dance or learning how to sing to improve their, what they call their qi zhi, so their air or their energy. This is something that Chinese women really focus on. They all want to be elegant, yo ya, and they all want to have qi zhi, which is kind of like, it's like a presence, like a kind of like grace. They all want to have a kind of grace. And now you have things like skincare and oral hygiene. Oral hygiene is the fastest growing category on Taobao this year.
Wow.
And that's mouthwash, toothbrushes, you know, water picks, all sorts of things.
This is all related, I think. So qi zhi, for me, is very much related to almost like self-confidence, right? Because if you're confident, you radiate that, and then you create this kind of like qi zhi attitude. Is it fair then to say that when brands are looking to enter the market and they want to appeal to these audiences, they should, it's kind of like, they need to remember that Chinese luxury consumers are moving from almost like a peer approval kind of attitude towards buying goods to self-gratification attitude of buying goods. So how do they feel inside when they wear something or when they buy something, rather than focusing on kind of like gaining peer approval and showing people that they're able to afford something like this? Is that correct? Or do you think it's shifting towards less overt branding?
Or is that still the case? Millennials a lot of them are looking for more niche brands. So let's say Glossier, right? Charlotte Tilbury.
Yeah.
But again, you know, that's sort of very forward thinking millennials. The thing is that China's so big and you have huge masses of population in second, third, fourth, fifth tier cities that are also rising out of poverty and part of the emerging middle class, that actually it's just different waves. So I think, you know, for these luxury brands, there's never going to be a day when Chinese people won't buy them, right? Because you always have people, right, who are kind of entering like the new rich. But, you know, what you do have is people who've been buying the first tier luxury brands for a long time. Now they're looking for something more independent, right?
Sure, they're maturing as consumers.
Right, and it's not just about the brand and the label, but also, okay, you know, the quality and those kinds of things.
Craftsmanship.
Yeah.
I guess that leads nice down to the next talking point. And this is a question we have with a lot of brands that we work with. High net worth individual, probably one of the hardest audience to get attention from. So what do you think, from your experience, are the best ways? Is it magazines? Is it influencers? What do you think are the best ways to grab the attention of high net worth individuals in China as a brand?
I think right now, content and commerce are so tied together, especially in China. And the thing is that there's a lack of premium content. That's why I came out with the Sarah Show. Which, you know, the look, the feel of it is very international. And so I think that in terms of getting the word out there, firstly, a lot of it is word of mouth. So, you know, social, kind of being on WeChat Moments, etc. I think that people don't like hard marketing anymore. They want it to be nuanced marketing.
So these guys we're talking about, they do use social media, right?
Which guys? The luxury brands?
Luxury consumers, yeah.
Everybody uses social media.
They use social media, yeah.
And in fact, what they're using is short-form video content. So whereas in 2016, 2017, only like 20% of marketers, because there have been surveys done on this, 20% of marketers use short-form video content.
Yeah.
In 2018, you had like 60, 70% of marketers using short-form video content.
I think short-form, we had an episode literally just before this one talking just about short-form video. And it's astonishing how fast that format has grown over the last 2 years, you know, literally like exploded. No one was using it back just 2 years ago. And last year was the first year that WeChat engagement went down rather than up on average, and short-form video skyrocketed. It's crazy, and we tell this to clients all the time that it's a platform, Douyin is a platform right now where you can still get organic traction outside your followers. So you know a platform is new, you can get more engagement than you have followers, whereas stuff like Weibo and WeChat, you're very kind of like very much limited based on how many followers and how much reach you have. Personally, it's very hard to get organic traction.
So you're seeing all the platforms, you know, they're starting out by like going as wide as possible to capture as big an audience as possible. And TikTok, Douyin, was a good example of this. A year ago, none of the sort of high quality KOLs or high quality brands wanted to be on Douyin because it was considered so low.
Sure.
But now, this year, all the A-list Chinese celebs are on it. You have, you know, China CCTV, like all these really serious news broadcasters and all the luxury brands on it, because Douyin is trying, now that they've got their mass user base, they're trying to upgrade and go premium.
It's maturing as a platform.
And yeah, and that's why then I opened my Douyin account, right?
You have a Douyin account?
I just started it 2 weeks ago because it's also very tied to commerce.
Yeah. So just to summarize, because a lot of people don't believe that high net worth individuals or luxury consumers have the time to go on social media, but that's not really the case, right? They are on social media, they're using Douyin, they're using WeChat, and they respond to influencers. They use Little Red Book, and they respond to influencers.
Absolutely. I mean, in China, I think like 90% of 90% of millennials buy online. I mean, it's an online economy.
But do they buy big ticket items online as well, do you think? Or is that more kind of like brick and mortar still?
How big is big ticket? You know something? There was a KOL that sold Mini Coopers. I think it was like a certain number of Mini Coopers online, and within 10 minutes, they all sold out.
Wow. I was thinking a little bit smaller, but that's big. okay, so I guess this is a nice time to move on to the industry rather than just kind of focusing on consumers. And again, for the benefit of our listeners, a lot of our listeners are marketers themselves. Do you have any examples of the best foreign brands that are doing well to connect with Chinese luxury consumers?
I think the best foreign brands that do well are the ones that stay authentic to themselves. Aesop is actually doing really well, the Australian self-care brand. And I mean, they are perfectionists. Even their stores, whether it's in Hong Kong IFC, or unfortunately, they can't open stores in China yet because they don't do animal testing. But you know, every store they open all over the world, they are so, you know, they'll delay the opening, like, because they'll just wait until it's perfect before getting it done. So they stay really true to their brand. But you know, you can do cross-border e-commerce in China, and they still have a nice business where a lot of, you know, sort of more forward early adopters, you know, so Chinese women are buying their stuff. So I think that, you know, sometimes you'll see, for example, a jewelry brand where it's, you know, they're Italian or they're French, and all of a sudden in the next series they come out with a dragon design, and it's like, come on, guys.
I hate that.
It's like, really? Like, you're really just doing this for the Chinese market? Come on.
You know, you get like something red, something that's like a paper cutout, and we always have this internal joke in the office about just this stuff is just so cliche, you know? It's almost like they're being orientalist or...
But you know, it's not true to their own DNA.
And
Chinese can see right through that. You know, it's like Chinese are very sophisticated shoppers now.
It's a very good point.
And then of course you have to be careful with the political climate. So because, you know, Chinese netizens, nothing goes unnoticed.
Yeah.
If let's say it's to do with, you know, political geography, or you know, even just, you know, it can be very sensitive, right? So Dolce & Gabbana did a huge mess up. And then even like about, you know, a month ago recently, a lot of brands got in trouble for their websites. And, you know, things are very sensitive now. So and to me, it's surprising. You're such a big brand. So much of your market comes from China, but you don't have somebody to specifically look out for these things.
It's a very good point. It's like, who's approving this stuff, right?
Right.
It's a very good point. So it's to stay authentic, but at the same time, you need to be aware of cultural sensitivities in a sense that what you do, especially in case Dolce & Gabbana, where their kind of satirical, rebellious nature and personality work in the West, might not work in China because of
the people. Just so sensitive. It's getting more and more sensitive.
Yeah. Sustainability. I know it's like a big topic that a lot of the luxury brands are talking about right now, at least in the West. is this just a brand thing, or do Chinese consumers actually care about sustainability?
I think now Chinese consumers are starting to care about their own health. But I think that just like it's a progress, you know, you have to make money before you care about charity, before you care about giving it away.
You gotta have the time to do it. Yeah. Right?
And right now, sustainability is just the last priority. Mm. It's not, you know, I mean, I think for brands to sell on a sustainability angle is not really the... It's not particularly appealing for Chinese consumers now.
It's not like the top
it's three not the top
things.
Thing. But yeah. But it's I'm sure it's going to get there, maybe in 10 years.
Do you think as, because we were talking about different groups of consumers coming up as they're maturing, do you think like the most mature consumers, maybe it's higher up on their list than those that are kind of like coming up in tier 3 and tier 4 cities?
Well, actually, I think a lot of it is also top down. And now, so the government just came out about, you know, a month or two ago with
point.
Recycling. In
yeah.
Shanghai.
The
Laji Fenlei.
Yeah.
So you have to separate, you know, plastic goods with household goods,
yeah, we
with like batteries, with
office.
All sorts of stuff. And then it's just going to be, you know, Beijing's going to come next. They start off with Shanghai. So, you know, a lot of it is top down too. And I think it's great. You know, I think that the Chinese government for them to focus on this because recycling and, you know, pollution and plastics are such a big problem. And, you know, in the ocean. So it's something that I'm very passionate about. But I think that it'll take some time for the average Chinese consumer to start caring about that.
I think so as well. The final thing we want to ask you about in relation to kind of luxury industry was the idea of affordable luxury, especially you said earlier, I think it was like 400 million
millennials
that are coming up as middle class. Do you think affordable luxury is taking over due to the rise of middle class in China rather than ultra high net worth individuals?
I think affordable luxury is the next big thing everywhere. And in fact, you know, it's been picking up everywhere. I think people starting to realize a lot of it is maybe marketing.
yes.
And so, you know, for us, because, you know, we also recommend products as well. A lot of people ask me, you know, what skincare products are you using, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, I don't think that, you know, having a good lifestyle is necessarily having the most expensive lifestyle.
Yeah.
I think it's mixing it up. So, you know, having that Zara t-shirt with, you know, maybe your, you know, Chanel jacket, etc. So, and I think that this is the way forward. This is how people are living. You know, it's people want to curate their own lives. People want to mix high and low. They want to, you know, it's okay if they wear high heels and they go to a hot pot place, right? It's like mixing it up. So, I think that for me, I don't want to always just say, oh, you know, the best thing is the most expensive thing.
You get a certain level of diminishing return, right, when you get to the ultra high end as well, where maybe what you put into it doesn't equal to the kind of the increment that you're putting in. So what we like to do on the show always is we like to talk about the future and kind of like where the industry is going. And we always think that China right now, because it's moving so fast, it almost gives the rest of the world a preview of what's happening over the next kind of 5 to 10 years. And we touched on some of this briefly. The first thing we like to talk about, and I'm quite passionate about this as well, and I think China is moving, we talk about this a lot, and how China is moving from a nation of copycats, a nation of innovators, how made in China is changing to designed in China. Are you seeing from kind of like your experience with people and talking with consumers that are people starting to look internally and domestically for luxury products? Does that market exist? Is it growing?
It is. It's growing like crazy. So I don't think that international brands or Western brands should feel threatened because the Chinese market is so big. But I think, you know, there has been a rise of nationalism recently, and especially I think with the trade war that's going on and a lot of, you know, Western countries in many ways feeling threatened by China as a growing power and attacking China, then, you know, I think it's understandable then for, you know, Chinese nationals to feel like, okay, well, you know, if we're being attacked by foreign countries, then we want to help support our own domestic economy. And actually, domestic spending is not that high. It's something like 20% of GDP right now. So it's definitely something that the Chinese government needs to, even though in terms of numbers, it's very high. But in terms of percentage of GDP, actually investment is like way bigger than consumption. So there's a lot of growth for the Chinese government to move it that way.
Mm.
A girlfriend of mine, her father founded a down jacket brand called Bo Si Deng.
Oh, really? Of course I know Wolfstein.
Yeah, the Gao family. Yeah, so Jessica's a girlfriend of mine, and I was just with her in Shanghai, and she was saying that, you know, they've been hitting it out of the ballpark. I mean, because also I think that Chinese brands are also trying to go international. And I think the ones that are doing right are, for example, you know, her father's very smart, very forward-thinking. He's hired Italian designers. And, you know, for
Borsodeng. Yeah.
And he tries to make it, you know, a very professional team. And so they've done really well. So now, and so they have really cool brand, you know, really cool designs. Alessandra Ambrosio opened their show in New York Fashion Week last year, wearing a super cool, you know, jacket. And they had Anne Hathaway at the show. So, you know, I mean, they're doing really, really well. Of course, I think that one area where I think us Chinese brands can learn from the West is really the brand DNA.
I think so.
I mean,
I agree.
You know, foreign brands, like, they really get it right. They, you know, think about what is our mission, what is our vision, and it's more long term. Whereas a lot of Chinese brands, it's short term, but that's okay. You know, I think it'll be a matter of time. It's only a matter of time when we have Chinese brands that have a strong soul, strong DNA, are authentic to themselves, and that way attract people to the brand as opposed to trying to, you know, just force themselves on consumers.
And it's not necessarily their fault, because that's the way that Chinese market has worked, and that's the way they've been successful in China domestically. So it's difficult for them to envisage and change their mentality. You know, well, actually, what you've been doing and what made you successful needs to change, because if you want to work on the global market, you need to focus more on brand, as you said, and less on kind of like just sales tactics, like pushing distribution tactics, sales tactics, which is kind of what I think even Wolfstone has been doing that very well in China. They have huge amount of stores in China. It's interesting you brought that up, actually, because I noticed they recently opened up again their Oxford Street store.
Right,
it was closed and it was reopened.
Yeah, so they realigned. They closed down all their men's and kids and decided to only just focus on down. So like any company, they figure out what works, what doesn't work.
They evolve. That's fantastic.
So, you know, they're evolving. They continually learn.
Let me ask you something. Do you think, I have my own philosophy on why I think Chinese brands are opening up in the West. I think a lot of times it's less about trying to grow their market share in the West, more about increasing their brand equity in China. Is that right? Do you agree?
Well, you know, I think that it's true, because when let's say third or fourth tier city Chinese tourists come to London, and on Oxford Street they see, oh, Borsodeng.
Exactly.
Then they might think, wow, this is a 国际品牌. This is an international brand. So then when they go back to China, right, it raises their visibility and their brand equity. And I think, you know, that is also part of it too.
So do you know, because you have the inside track, are they trying to expand globally, or is it about brand equity?
I think maybe it's a bit of both.
Yeah? So we'll see more of that. You don't want to say too much. And then the final thing is, again, we touched on this earlier briefly. I just want to kind of get your opinion on it. You know, I think it's a ridiculous comment, because people talk about this. They're like, oh, you know, China's slowing down its economic growth. It's finally not grown to double digits. You know what? The US and UK hasn't grown double digits for decades now. I think it is a slowdown technically, and I have noticed stats where luxury spending is decreasing. Sorry, not decreasing, decreasing in the way it's growing. So it's still growing. Do you think brands need to stop relying on China? Because a lot of brands, where a majority of their sales do come from Chinese customers.
I think that brands definitely have to take China seriously, which they all do. They all take China seriously, because think about it. If 40% of the luxury market is going to be from China in you know, 5 years, then how can you ignore what is potentially a huge income generator? But I think at the same time, just as, you know, any business or any investment, you don't want to be over reliant on one area, one geography. And you're kind of starting to see that now, where, you know, tourism in Thailand, tourism in Philippines, Southeast Asia, most of their tourists, they were heavily reliant on Chinese tourists. Because I think for Chinese tourists, the first place they go out to is Southeast Asia. It's nearby, they like the food, it's more affordable. And so Southeast Asia, in a lot of countries, were building more hotels, investing in their tourism infrastructure to cater to Chinese. And now with, you know, there's been a 50% drop in Chinese tourists going to Southeast Asian countries. Or even if you look at Cathay Pacific, right now with everything going on, and Cathay Pacific relied heavily on the Chinese market. And, you know, with all the disruption going on and, you know, Cathay having a reshuffle in that the chairman was laid off, their CEO was laid off. And so they just came out yesterday with news saying that they're down 50% in Chinese customers. And so, you know, I think it's... So that's why I think that it's not good, because they were really reliant on the Chinese economy. So I think, but it's a tough balance, right? It's like there's so much opportunity, but there's also that risk.
How do you take advantage of the opportunity, but at the same time not put your eggs in one basket?
By being sensitive. By being, you know, sensitive and empathetic to cultural and political norms. I'm glad you're
saying that. Understanding the people and culture foremost, more than anything, more than the platforms, more than technology, more than strategy. And I think a lot of people, and we say this all the time, people forget that everything is driven by people, right?
Emotions.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think what we're doing is so great, because it really goes back to the source. It's about the people. It's about how they behave. It's about the social disposition, which I think China has a lot of catching up to do on, despite the fast economic growth. Yeah, and I think that's a fantastic place to finish on. Thank you very much for your time, Sarah, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your time in London.
Thank you, Arnold.